we know as John the Baptist. And I admit that I face the task of writing my annual John the Baptist sermon with a little bit of trepidation each year, because I'm never really sure what to say about the guy. I'm not entirely comfortable. I'm not entirely confident that I know what he's doing in the story. I need to figure out what we're doing with our...
Should I have this on or that? I turned on my... Good, thank you. I forgot to turn on my battery pack. I'm sorry. There are days when it seems like there's a lot of sort of silly mistakes that happen in church, and today's one of them. It's probably because there's a lot of people here, and I want to make sure everything goes really well to impress you. Carl Jung, the great philosopher, once said that the Holy Spirit shows up among us as the holy fool, kind of keeping us humble, keeping us on our toes, and I definitely feel God's presence that way this morning. So thank you for being such a good and kind and understanding people as you are. Anyway, I think I was saying something about the fact that I have a hard time remembering or have a hard time knowing what to say about John the Baptist each year when the second Sunday of Advent comes around, because I'm not entirely confident that I know what John the Baptist is doing in the story. As a lover of narrative and of storytelling, I must confess that if I were given the job of editing the Gospels, I might just edit John the Baptist out. I don't have anything against John the Baptist. And I'm sure that John's presence in the Gospels was terribly meaningful to the people who wrote the Gospels in the first century. But I don't think that the Gospel writers did a very good job of explaining John in ways that make sense 2,000 years later and halfway around the world. Besides, it's hard for me to write a sermon about John the Baptist, because in order to write a sermon, you kind of have to focus, right? That makes sense? And whenever I write about John the Baptist, whenever I think about John the Baptist, my mind wanders off to Italy. And sometimes I'd rather be in Italy. Like many white Americans, I am of mixed ethnic ancestry. I talk a lot about being Scottish, and some of you may have noticed that I was wearing a kilt last Sunday. But I also have ancestors who come from England and Ireland and Wales and from the Mi'kmaq people of Nova Scotia. But it happens that I'm also Italian, because my stepfather is Italian. And my stepfather's mother was the only grandparent I ever knew. So I am culturally and emotionally, if not exactly biologically, Italian. My great-grandparents immigrated from a couple of little villages between Lake Lugano and Lake Como, right on the Swiss border. And I visited those villages a few times, and I've gotten to know some of my Italian second and third cousins fairly well. In fact, I'm probably closer to some of my second and third Italian cousins than I am to most of my first cousins in the United States. At any rate, I've got a cousin named Giovanni, and Giovanni loves taking me to visit churches in Italy because I'm a pastor. And Giovanni is a very devout Roman Catholic physician. And when we visited the little village church where Giovanni was raised and where he continues to worship and where my great-grandfather was baptized, the thing that Giovanni was most eager to show me was a little side chapel dedicated to John the Baptist, who is the saint after whom Giovanni is named, Giovanni being John in Italian. And in that chapel, there's a statue of John the Baptist made out of the local marble, which is kind of red-colored and it looks blood-stained. And Giovanni told me, before we went to this chapel, Giovanni told me there was a remarkable statue of John the Baptist. And I went there expecting that it would be a traditional depiction of Jesus' cousin, dressed in skins and looking a little bit like a hippie. Instead, it was a very realistic depiction of John the Baptist's severed head on a platter. And dearly beloved, I love Italy. And I love my cousin Giovanni. But try as I might, I cannot unsee that image of John the Baptist's head carved from the blood-stained marble of northern Lombardy sitting in that beautiful church. Of course, that is an image taken from later in the life of John the Baptist. Well, actually, it's probably best to say it's an image taken from early in the death of John the Baptist. And today's lesson, and indeed all of the stories that we use to associate John the Baptist with the Christmas story, these are all stories taken from earlier in John's life when he's described as something of a wild man, dressed in animal skins, eating bugs, having long hair and a beard, looking in fact like some of the teachers at the Mendocino Grammar School when I was enrolled there in the 1970s. And I think that may be really the best way to understand John's role in the Gospels, the way for me to understand it anyway, the way to keep me from editing it out. John was Jesus' teacher. The idea that John was in some ways Jesus' teacher is not original to me. There are lots of traditions that suggest John was some kind of mentor to Jesus, and that's not exactly biblical, but it is conjecture, a conjecture which may be rooted in the archetype of the wild man as shaman, as mentor, as spiritual guide. Think of Iron John or Merlin or Obi-Wan Kenobi or Albus Dumbledore. The great mentors and wise men in literature often look like John the Baptist, with long hair and beards, like the male teachers of my childhood. And by the way, this is why I like Jesus so much. Not only did Jesus and I both have stepfathers who were carpenters, and I know some of my relatives might insist that despite every bit of evidence to the contrary, St. Joseph San Giuseppe was actually an Italian carpenter, like my dad. Not only did Jesus and I both have Italian carpenter stepfathers, but Jesus and I both had teachers who were hippies. And it's probably no small thing for the Gospels to name John as Jesus' teacher. As far as anyone knows, back then John probably was more famous than Jesus, so for Jesus to have John as a teacher may have been something of a celebrity endorsement. But regardless of John's relative fame, his work as Jesus' teacher was to help Jesus bring out and to give voice to the divine nature, the Christ, that resided within him. And John's work as teacher to the Messiah makes me wonder how we can be inspired by John. Of course, we can admire John, but can his work be our work? After all, the world needs people willing to teach one another ways to bring out the divine goodness in all of us. And can we do that? Can we teach one another to recognize and to live out the divine spark that is within us? Can we be that kind of teacher, one for the other? I'm convinced that despite all the evils we humans manage to inflict on one another, still, there is a divine spark in each one of us, because I am a person of faith, and I believe we are created in God's image. The trouble with humanity is that too many of us have yet to learn about that divine goodness, yet to learn how to express that goodness with kindness and compassion and understanding. And I wonder, what if each of us was to take on the work that was John's? What if each of us were to commit to teaching others how to give expression to the divine goodness that still exists in each human heart? I realize that not all of us are formal teachers, but all of us influence others, even if we don't know we're doing it, even if we don't want to do it. Of course, if we're parents, we teach our children. If we're in positions of leadership, we teach those who work for us, and we should do what we can do in those capacities to teach those around us to give expression to God's Spirit within them. But even if we're not instructing or leading in a formal way, even if we're not teachers, if we're not parents, if we're not leaders, still we teach all the time. We even teach with the way we drive our cars. We teach with the way we relate to strangers. We teach with the way we treat folks who are waiting on us in restaurants or selling us groceries at the supermarket. All of us are teachers, because all of us, by our actions, are informing other people's views on the relative goodness of humanity. When we are gracious and kind, that inspires others to match our gracious kindness, which is to say, it teaches others to bring forth the divine spark that is within them. I feel like the need to teach others to express God's Spirit alive within them, I think it's taken on greater urgency in the last couple of weeks. You all know this. We had a mass shooting in Colorado 1 week ago, and then the following week we had shootings in Savannah, Georgia, and most notably in San Bernardino. And there's been, on average, at least one shooting every day so far this year, one mass shooting. A mass shooting being defined as more than four people hit. And when the shooter's a Muslim or has a Muslim-sounding name, the Islamophobes among us start crying out for a ban on immigration from Muslim countries, and even if those who want to come to America are refugees. And when the shooter is a conservative, white, pro-life terrorist, people like me start shouting about double standards in the media. We ask why Fox News doesn't generalize about evangelical pro-lifers in the way it generalizes about Muslims. This is one of yours, we say. Will you denounce his violence? And I'm totally guilty of this. And I still think the American people need to address and confront the double standards we apply to Muslim perpetrators of violence and terror. But we need to do this not by saying, this killer was one of yours because you also are pro-life, or one of mine because I have long advocated for a tolerant understanding of Islam. Rather, whenever anyone commits an act of terrorism or of random violence, each one of us needs to say, the perpetrator is one of ours, because we are humans. We can't just ask, what's wrong with those people? We need to ask, what's wrong? Has happened to us? What has happened to us as a community and as a nation? What's happened to us as a human race? Because we're all connected. And when we acknowledge that connection, when we claim the tie that binds us even to the most vile among us, then we are acknowledging the divine within us and within others. And when we acknowledge the divine in an active way, we cannot help but teach others to do the same. We cannot help but be, in a small way, John the Baptist. Now, I want to end this sermon with a word of grace, because I suspect some of you, like me, may be wondering, what if I fail? What if I go ahead and forward that meme about Republicans that's nasty but oh so sweetly clever? What if I'm short with my kids? What if I give that terrible driver the one-fingered salute because she took my parking place at the mall? What if I'm unkind to the harried waitstaff? What if I didn't bring forth the Spirit of God to those around me? Or worse yet, what if I'm doing a good job teaching others to find the divine spark within them, but what I'm doing isn't sufficient? What if I'm doing a good job teaching others to recognize the divine within them, but what I'm doing isn't sufficient to counter the crap that others are teaching? You may have seen a video that went viral over the last few days in which Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, a conservative evangelical or fundamentalist university in Virginia. You may have seen this. He's speaking at a chapel service there at Liberty University, encouraging something like 12,000 mostly cheering students to get concealed gun permits so that they can, and I quote, end those Muslims. What if our efforts to teach love and peace cannot match that vile pedagogy? Well, let me invite your mind to wander back to Italy with me. My cousin Giovanni speaks of going to church each Sunday of his childhood and looking at that grotesque, violent statue of John the Baptist. His parents and his priests, various nuns and neighbors, all told him that this was his saint. This is the inspiration for your name. Dearly beloved, I'm pretty sure there should be an 800 number you can call to make a report when they do that kind of thing to you at church. And yet I'm here to tell you, Giovanni has turned out just fine, more than fine. He is a gentle and kind village doctor who has delivered most of the people in the village of Iju that are under the age of, I don't know, 35. Everyone loves him. He's one of the kindest, most gentle people I know. The spark of the Spirit of God is very much alive in Giovanni, despite that weird, ugly image that he grew up looking at. It turns out that the Spirit of God is much bigger and much stronger than human frailty. And the good people in Giovanni's life taught him to express God's love and peace in other ways that were bigger than the awfulness of that statue. Now, it's a small thing to overcome a grotesque statue and turn out wonderful, as Giovanni has. But I have to believe that what happened in a small way for Giovanni can happen in a much bigger way for humans everywhere. We can learn to be better. We can learn to express the divine spark that is in each of us. But we have to be taught, which means that we have to teach one another. This is what John did for Jesus and what we must do for each other and for God's children everywhere. We must and we can, which is why I still live in hope. Again and again, humans have let the divine spark within us shine in deep darkness, and the darkness has not been able to stand against it. And that is my Advent wish for you. My wish for you is that the Spirit of Christ will be reborn in us once again, and violence such as we've seen in Colorado Springs and Savannah and San Bernardino and Syria and Lebanon and Paris, this violence will cease as we, like John the Baptist, teach one another to live and to walk in the Spirit of God. Amen.